This is 9/11 Freefall.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of 9/11 Freefall. My name is Andy Steele, and I am the host. Tonight, we'll be joined by Richard Gage and Dylan Avery. They're going to be talking about AE 9/11 Truth's newest documentary film project. This is a long interview, so we're going to get right into it. It's coming your way right now.
The views expressed on this show by guests and the hosts on issues outside of the 9/11 controlled demolition evidence are the opinions of those individuals alone and do not necessarily reflect those of architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth.
Dylan Avery is an acclaimed filmmaker that has made numerous documentaries, short films, and music videos. His police brutality documentary, Black and Blue, won Best Documentary at the Catalina Film Festival. His documentary on CBD, Magic Molecule, is currently distributed by Random Media. A documentary he edited and co-produced called The Professional, a Stevie Blatt story, premiered at Slamdance 2019. And last but not least, he is the creator of Loose Change. He's here on the show today. Dylan, welcome to 9/11 Freefall.
Andy, thank you for having me.
And he's joined by none other than Richard Gage, AIA. Richard is a San Francisco Bay Area architect of 30 years. He's a member of the American Institute of Architects, and he is the founder and president of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, which represents more than 3,000 architects and engineers who have signed our petition demanding a new investigation of the destruction of all three World Trade Center skyscrapers on 9/11. During his architectural career, Richard has worked on most types of building construction, including numerous fireproof steel frame buildings. He's been all over the world talking about the 9/11 evidence, giving presentations either in person or virtually, does the webinar every week, does so many things to get this issue pushed to the forefront, and he is still going. And Richard, welcome back to 9/11 Freefall.
Great to be back with you again, Andy.
So we have a very special episode today because there's an important project going on, and we've already told our supporters about it in a bulletin, an article that went out last week, but we want to talk more about it today. Richard, why don't you begin by letting our supporters know why both you and Dylan Avery are here on 9/11 Freefall and what AE 9/11 Truth is doing?
We are excited because we've now succeeded, with our donors' help, funding a $300,000 four-year study of the Building 7 finite element analysis, which the University of Alaska released early in September. And we are incorporating the final comments from the reviewers, and that is going into the final report, which is expected to be released early January. So we need to find a way to tell our supporters and the world about this study, a major university study which pulls the rug out from underneath the NIST report, which of course concluded 7 years after 9/11, that this building came down due to normal office fires. And of course, those of us who have been up on the truth about 9/11 from early on know that it's explosives and incendiaries that brought down Building 7. And so we want to tell the world, particularly engineers in the world and the media, who's just been censoring this subject, what really went on here. Because this study, as we'll talk about today, concludes that nope, office fires could not have brought that building down. Something far more sinister, as we'll see, is what was responsible there.
Exactly. And this is something that we have been talking about for a number of years. A lot of evidence has come out, a lot of study on this one particular building, something that hardly got a mention in the corporate media on the day of 9/11. And most times that it has been mentioned has been in response to the 9/11 truth movement. The typical message is, look elsewhere, don't look at this, there's nothing to it. But we have done a lot to try to get mention of this building in the media and get this cemented in people's minds. I really believe, too, when you talk about Building 7, it actually influences other issues, because it's sort of like spray painting, remember Building 7 on any agenda that tries to get presented to us now. It's like, hey, they lied to you about this, what else are they lying about? And I think that's a good thing. I think we need a more skeptical public.
I just wanted to add in, before we introduce our esteemed guest, that, I mean, Loose Change was one of the movies that just turned me upside down in my world thinking. This was now 12, 13 years ago. And so we thought, my God, Dylan Avery has been on it, you know, since then. So and creating these incredible films that you mentioned, why not go back to the film that had 20 million views, the filmmaker, one of them, the key one, and get him to tell the world about this Halsey study in this incredible documentary that we really want to do. So that's why we brought Dylan Avery here, too, and that's what AE 9/11 Truth is so excited about right now.
And I'm not being hyperbolic in saying this. I really believe that when this all comes out, Loose Change is going to be one of those films that lives on in history, because this was a film that touched a lot of people, put the seeds in people's minds. A lot of these people now are still involved in 9/11 Truth, and most times when somebody says that they've heard of this issue before, 9 times out of 10 they'll mention Loose Change as the film that got them started. Someday, I don't know how you put a DVD or an internet film in the Smithsonian, but they'll figure out something, and I think they're going to force kids to watch this as part of history class. By that time, it'll all be exposed, and to them, it'll just be homework that they're forced to review, but I think it's going to be that important in terms of waking up the general public and leading us to a path of final justice. So we're producing this movie. Dylan is the filmmaker. This is something that has really excited the movement in the past couple of weeks. And of course, we're going to talk about it today. But in case there are people unaware of you, Dylan, and your work, they may have just woken up to 9/11 a few weeks ago, and they're just catching up with all of the great people that have made this issue push to the forefront of the public's consciousness, I want you to fill those people in. Since you were on the ground floor of the truth movement, what got you into filmmaking and what led you to deciding to make Loose Change back in the day when you were in college?
Oh, boy. Well, this is going to be fun. You know, I grew up with a single mother who worked a lot, so we didn't really have a lot of time together during the week. And the time that we did have together, either when she was done with work during the week or when we had our weekends together, we spent a lot of time watching movies. You know, we would hit the old Sunrise Video, and you know, we'd get either some new stuff that had come out, or we'd go through the archives and watch some older films. One night, you know, we did a marathon of all the Alien films. So the film was always kind of a big part of my life growing up, and I even go so far as to say that film was my father. You know, my mother was my mother, and film was my father. So I guess I always just kind of grew up somewhat familiar with the language of filmmaking, and it was something that was just kind of always ingrained into my head. I didn't put much thought to the idea of being a filmmaker. You know, when I was a kid, I wanted to make video games for a living. That was my goal. And then around like age 13 or 14, you know, my mother's friend, Dylan Ford, he had recorded an album with his band on a 4-track in their garage. And I mean, even that to me was impressive at the time, because as far as I knew, music was only made in these big, expensive studios. And, you know, if it wasn't on the radio, it didn't exist. So to actually put in a cassette tape into the car stereo for my mom to be like, oh, this is my friend's band, it was like, wow, he recorded this in his garage? That's crazy. So the final song on that album was called Yucatan. And basically, I really love the whole album, but out of all the songs that were on the album, I was like, oh, well, let me let me make a music video for this song. And so this is back in the Encarta days. I don't know how many listeners or you guys remember Encarta, but it was basically a like a CD-ROM-based encyclopedia that was pretty big in the schools at the time. And it came with a bunch of video clips of all the different historical events that the encyclopedia was discussing. So I actually had a friend that had Encarta. He ripped a bunch of the videos off of there, gave them to me, and I edited my first music video at the age of like 13. And, you know, leading up to that, I was, you know, I was part of the MTV generation, so music videos were on all the time. There was one in particular, Pearl Jam's Jeremy. You know, this is back when, you know, when you wanted to watch a music video, you had to just basically watch MTV ad nauseum until you saw the video again. And I remember seeing Jeremy, the music video, and I was just blown away by it. And I spent a good part of the next couple of years just trying to find, like, an actual copy of it. And I didn't have much success, so I would occasionally see it on TV, but other than that, I didn't really have much luck. So I think that was where my pivot away from designing video games to making movies started to shift fully. And then by the time I was a junior in high school, I joined a visual arts class along with my buddy Corey, and we started getting familiar with green screening and just shooting stuff and digital editing, digital effects, etc. So that really started to put me more on the path even more. And then from there, I started reading scripts of movies. You know, I would find a website that had scripts from some of my favorite films. I would start reading them. I eventually participated in the very first Project Greenlight, which was the contest held by Ben Affleck and Matt Damon through HBO, where basically you would submit your script and the winning screenwriter would get a deal to not only have their script directed, but to direct it themselves. Which, looking back, is kind of a strange choice because writers are usually not directors and vice versa. I mean, some directors are writers, but a lot of screenwriters just like to write scripts. That's what they do. So I participated in the first Project Greenlight. I obviously didn't win, which is fine because my script is terrible. But, you know, I got hooked. I got hooked on the craft. So, you know, I bounced around a couple ideas. I started writing some stuff down just in kind of outline format and just developing some characters, but I knew that I wanted to take a crack at writing another script. And then September 11th happened, just as I was finishing up high school. And, you know, I had some early suspicions about September 11th. I mean, I watched a good percentage of it on TV when it went down, but I think I was actually, because I was only taking one class at school at the time. So basically, my friend Sandy and I had just gotten back to my house from breakfast. We were just about to take back off to the school, and she got a call on her cell phone from her mom saying, "Oh, you need to turn on the TV." "Well, what channel?" "Oh, well, any channel." And so we did, and we saw the Twin Towers burning right there on TV. And I had to leave, so I didn't see the collapses live. I only saw them later on after I had made it to school. And by that point, you know, they were obviously replaying it a bunch, but it was mostly just a discussion of, you know, what to do next and, you know, Ground Zero smoldering into the sky. So it wasn't really until, I would say, you know, it's already mid-September, I would say later that year, but probably earlier in 2002, there was something about it that just kind of stuck with me. So I started researching it online. I started trying to find any video clips that I could of the collapse. I mean, again, to reiterate to anyone who may not have been around at that point, you know, there was no YouTube, there was no Google Video, there was none of that. Like, the extent of the videos that were shared online were, like, low-resolution MPEG files that you had to wait a half hour for them to download. But, you know, the biggest piece for me back in 2002 was the complete 9/11 timeline, which was basically just a website that was devoted entirely to what the military said they did that day. The timelines of the planes being scrambled, where they were scrambled from, where they were sent to. And a lot of the early analysis was pointing to multiple stories and multiple versions of what happened. And that was kind of a big thing for me, because I was like, if they can't even get their answers straight on how they responded to the greatest terrorist attack in history, then how are we supposed to trust them on any other aspect of that day? So it was around that same time, well, actually to backpedal a little bit, about June, July 2001, my buddy Corey, that I had gone to visual arts with, decided he was going to join the military. You know, we were we were young, but we were already kind of getting sick of our hometown, and we were trying to think of ways to get out. And Corey just needed his own escape. And a recruiter got into his head, and he decided he was going to join the military. And, you know, as he was leaving for basic training in August 2001, we all joked, like, oh, you know, Corey will be fine. There's not going to be a war anytime soon. So we were quickly proven wrong, and Corey was basically at the tip of the spear for the invasion of Afghanistan and later Iraq. So, you know, it's mid-2002. You know, I'm starting to have some serious doubts about September 11th, and I would say the official story, but at that point it was more a lack thereof. You know, the Bush administration was stonewalling on any kind of official investigation. At one point they suggested that they might appoint Henry Kissinger to head up the commission, and, you know, even knowing as little as I knew about the world back then, we all knew that that was a terrible idea. So while this is going on, you know, and while all these steps are being made towards, you know, foreign wars and land invasions and, you know, the potential dangerous path that our country was about to embark on, my buddy is overseas, you know, first fighting in Afghanistan and, you know, later Iraq. And he had mentioned to me, I think, like, maybe even in mid-2002, like, oh, we're here in Afghanistan right now, we're going to go to Iraq, then we're going to go to Iran, and then we're going to go here and there. And I was just like, this is crazy. Like, he's being sent on a war tour, like, to all these different countries. And meanwhile, as far as the public knows, like, we're all just in Afghanistan, and that's just the current mission. So, you know, I started to get a little worried about my buddy. You know, it's like I'd read, like, a newspaper or an article online, and it said something about a helicopter crash in Afghanistan, and I would have to wait a couple days to either hear back from Corey or to get one of those standard blue and red outlined envelopes in the mailbox that indicated to me that at least as of recently, he was okay. So, you know, there were a lot of things driving me at that point in time, and I knew that I wanted to say something about 9/11, and so I started to write a script, and the script focused around three friends who basically discovered that they were being lied to about 9/11 and embarked on a journey to spread that message however they could. And so I developed that script from 2002 to 2003. I was hesitant about telling Corey about it because he was, you know, he was very much swept up into the war machine. And, you know, I had even got an email from him in like 2002 where he's like, yeah, we're going to go get Al-Qaeda. And, you know, it's just kind of the standard stuff you get from someone who's been, I really hate to use the term brainwashed, so I will instead say has been kind of sucked up into the propaganda that they were feeding him. So, you know, and even when he came home for like Christmas 2002, he's like, oh, what have you been working on? And I kind of bluffed a little bit, and I was like, oh, I've been working on a couple things, nothing major. But it was around, I think it was around 2003, because Corey had his own experience where he got to Iraq. You know, like I said, he was the tip of the spear, so he was basically right there for the initial invasion of Baghdad. And he told me a story about how he landed in February 2003, and, you know, another soldier was, like, getting on the plane or leaving or whatever, and the guy basically told him that he had already been there for a year, and, like, a light bulb went off over Corey's head, or, you know, a fuse blew or something, and he was like, wait a minute. They're telling us that this is this imminent threat from Saddam Hussein, and, you know, this invasion just started happening, but these guys have been here preparing for this war for the last year. So I think if there was ever a, quote, awakening moment for Corey, then I think that would be it, because then from there the tone of our conversation started to shift, and I eventually felt safe enough to let him know, like, well, this is what I've been working on for the last couple of years. So I sent him pages from the script. Like, I basically had to make photocopies of pages that I had written and then send it to him in the mail. And he was like, dude, this is great. Like, I got some money coming up. I'm gonna buy a little camera, and the next time I'm home, we're gonna shoot some scenes for this movie. I was like, all right, man. And so, yeah, February 2004, he came back from Iraq. He had a little mini DV camera shipped to my house from Amazon, which was just starting to take off at that time. And he got home, and we shot a couple scenes, and then he went back to Iraq. And it was in the process of cutting together some of those scenes and just realizing the logistics that were going to be required. I mean, this script ended with, like, people rallying on the White House lawn. I realized, like, I don't think I'm going to be able to make this film. At least internally, I thought that. But then externally, I was still basically, because the plan at the time was that through one of the main characters' book, who was going to be the narrator, he would, every once in a while, like, he would either learn something or someone would say something to him, and the film would kind of pivot into documentary mode, and this character would kind of narrate a little montage, and then it would come back to the narrative film, and the story would progress from there. So basically, when mid-2004 rolled around, I had this kind of hybrid of, you know, a bunch of the scenes that we had shot, and then a bunch of these other little documentary segments that I had edited myself, and kind of trying to find a way for those two roads to meet in the middle. And the final catalyst for that was when I had a screening in Washington, D.C. You know, it took me a couple years longer than Corey to get out of Oneonta, but I finally did in April 2004. I'd been living down there, like I said, since April, so September 2004 rolls around. I'm working at the Starbucks in DuPont Circle, and there's this cool little independent cinema right up the road called Vision Cinema, which unfortunately no longer exists. And I was like, you know what? It's the three-year anniversary of 9/11 coming up. I already feel like I'm taking too long to get this thing done, and I feel the pressure of just wanting to get the word out and just wanting to spread this message however I could. So I put down a $500 deposit. I reserved the theater for September 11, 2004. I made little flyers. I handed them out to some, I don't want to say all my customers, but some customers that I knew and I felt comfortable with. I gave them flyers. Some of my coworkers, I gave them flyers for it. And so September 11, 2004 rolls around, and I show basically this hour-long work-in-progress cut of, of Loose Change. And, you know, it was after the screening. Everyone was pretty, you know, I don't want to say impressed by what they saw, but, you know, people definitely had things to say about it. And I don't remember exactly who came up to me and who said it, and it might have been a couple people, but basically the review that I got was, those scenes are all right, but you really should just focus on the information. And so that right there was the catalyst for me to just pivot entirely away from the narrative concept and just focus on the documentary part. And so, almost as if it was fate, about a month or so later, my landlord, Hernando, was like, hey, I got a, because I'd been renting out a giant basement apartment out in Silver Spring. I had had the place to myself for about a month, but even when I moved in, the landlord was like, just so you know, you're not going to have this whole basement to yourself forever. Like, you're going to have a roommate at some point. And I was like, this is fine. And it was great because he was still charging me as if I was renting one room. So it really didn't change anything for me. So, you know, I think like late October, early November rolls around, and I meet my new roommate, DJ Schooley, who was moving back to the D.C. area from L.A. And so, you know, at that point, you know, Loose Change, I was narrating on a crappy little Walmart microphone. I was using music from, like, the Beastie Boys and DJ Shadow and a whole bunch of music I did not own the rights to. And so when Schooley moved in and he had a professional condenser microphone and he played me some beats and I would start hearing him, you know, work on stuff in his studio, I was like, I gotta talk to this guy. I gotta see if I can work with him. And again, almost as if it was fate, once I started talking to him about the subject matter of the film, he's like, oh man, have you heard of this guy, Alex Jones? I got one of his movies here, Road to Tyranny. And I was like, yeah, you know, Alex is interesting. You know, he's definitely got his own style. And, you know, we were joking, and it's like, well, you know, Road to Tyranny is basically just a guy at a desk yelling at a camera for most of it. But, you know, I knew right there that I was in safe territory. So I told him more about the film. He's like, yeah, man, like, I'm on board. Like, you know, I got CDs full of beats. You know, you want to redo your voiceover? Let's do it. So that was, like I said, November 2004. And December, January, February, March, April, 5 months later, the first edition of Loose Change was released on DVD. And I, you know, was basically just promoting it through one forum and a couple other places I was posting. And, you know, it did all right. It started to spread around a little bit. KPFK out in Los Angeles, they heard about it. They got a copy, and they actually offered to use it as a premium for their next fund drive that was coming up in the summer. So, and, you know, this is a very long story, but basically right around the same time, Corey gets out of the military, and says, like, hey, man, you know, I'm getting out. I want to help you with this movie however I can, man. You know, this is really important, so you have my support. And so I told him, I was like, well, I actually need to go out to California. I got to go out to Los Angeles, and, you know, KPFK is using this for a fund drive. He's like, dude, I'd, I'd love to come with you. Can I buy a plane ticket? I was like, yeah, sure. So Corey got out of the military. He came straight up to my apartment in D.C. He crashed on my couch for a bit, and we flew out to Los Angeles. I had not only never been to California, but I had never even been on a plane before. So it was very interesting. We went out to L.A. We did a bunch of appearances. You know, we went on the radio. We went to all the screenings. And, you know, we could tell, like, just with the reaction of the audience after every screening, like, we knew we had something. But it was still only the first edition. And so, you know, we got feedback. You know, people were like, this works, this doesn't work. So we made a brand new opening for the film. Due to the success of the first edition, this 3D animator named Ryan Danan reached out to us and was like, hey, guys, you know, I really love what you did with Loose Change. Just so you know, I'm an animator. If there's anything that you need for, you know, whatever you're going to do next, and, you know, back at that point, the idea was basically to make, you know, Loose Change the director's cut, which is kind of a misnomer because the first edition was already a director's cut. But I knew that I wanted to change it significantly enough where it was going to be a new thing. And then I think, you know, the train of thought was basically, well, encyclopedias have editions, and we're basically making a video encyclopedia about 9/11, so I'll call it Loose Change Second Edition. And so I recruited Ryan to do some animation. I was like, look, we'd love to get something of, you know, the plane hitting the Pentagon, at least a recreation of what the official story says happened. And he's like, no problem. And, you know, I bought him a couple 3D models off of the site Turbo Squid. I gave them to him. And, you know, a month or so later, we had this awesome animation that was just like a complete game changer. And, you know, did a couple more tweaks. We managed to, we actually interviewed Willie Rodriguez while we were out in Los Angeles for the KPFK fundraiser, because Sophia Schafquat of 9/11 Mysteries had hit us up, and she's like, oh, we're gonna be meeting up with Willie in the next couple weeks, and if you want to meet up with him and do an interview, like, we would love to. So we got a very impressive animation of Flight 77 hitting the Pentagon. We got a great interview with Willie Rodriguez. We completely changed our opening, and on November 18th, 2005, the second edition of Loose Change was released, and dare I say, the rest is history.
And your film was one of the very first viral videos. I mean, there was no such thing as a viral video on the internet. It sort of created this phenomenon where all these people were going to Google Video and watching this thing and passing it around, to the point where I remember on YouTube they used to have most viewed videos after YouTube got formed. And there'd be 15-minute segments of Loose Change out there that would be at the very top of the list, so they ended up changing it to What's Hot, which is obviously determined by executives at YouTube and not by the actual view counts. They had to move that off of the page because I think they were concerned about people getting real information off of their platform instead of watching cat videos and whatnot. But we want that kind of effect here, and that is why we are pursuing this project, and that is why Richard and AE911 Truth and Dylan Avery are involved in making this film about World Trade Center 7. And then, Richard, I know that in discussing this upcoming film, it's been said behind the scenes that really the final nail is in the coffin. There really is nothing else the AE911 Truth can do to prove that the official story is wrong when it comes to why this building came down and that explosives had to be involved in destroying it. Now, since you are the founder of AE911 Truth, can you give your insight just on those sentiments? I mean, what else is there left to do to make the case that this building did not collapse just because of random office fires?
Yeah, we certainly made the case, as you mentioned, our technical evidence DVD, 9/11 Explosive Evidence Experts Speak Out, already provides the vast array of forensic evidence and eyewitness testimony and 40 experts in different fields. So what do we have to do? I mean, short of beating people over the head physically, well, this study now, it addresses the academic institutions. It hits them right between the eyes. And we've now sent this study to 45 universities across the country, those who offer Master of Science and Structural Engineering degrees, and 50 actual organizations, many of whom are part of the promoting the official lie of what happened to this building 7. So now we want to take the the director of Loose Change, we have this opportunity where our supporters have funded a $20,000 cinematic, and Dylan can describe this, but this is the opportunity now to highlight the actual author of this report and his PhD team of researchers, Professor Leroy Halsey, one of the top forensic structural engineers in the country. And we're going to send Dylan up there to do his magic and get to the bottom of what really happened. What we know is that they've proven now that in order to get this building to collapse in the manner that the videos, all 11 of them, show that it collapsed, they had to remove 650 columns all at once over an 8-story height. So that's the only way the building could fall symmetrically at free fall, straight down uniformly into its own footprint. In the case of the videos, after witnesses hear explosions. So these columns have to be removed in the computer finite element analysis program. And so when that happens, the building comes straight down. And short of that, all they could do is get the building to tip over, you know, removing a few columns on the northeast section of the building. That's what's going to happen. That's NIST theory, right? Remove column 79, and by gosh, the building initiates a series of propagation of local failures, that which they call a pancaking progressive collapse, basically, and that's completely disproven. None of that happens. None of the elements of the initiation of collapse theory that NIST highlights in their 1,000-page report could ever have happened. And the university also proves that they fraudulently omitted key structural components in order to get their initiation of collapse to even happen in the first place. So we're very excited about the opportunity to get this study on film and get it out to every engineer across the country.
Yes, indeed. And we are getting this out to as many engineers as we can. I mean, it really, really is something that I think about a lot. I mean, what else can we do? We funded this many hundreds of thousand dollar study to basically disprove what NIST has said. And now that it's out, there's people, our supporters are writing to NIST, telling them about this study, asking them to rationalize this contrast in different outcomes, asking for the input data. And NIST is totally in bunker mentality. They send the same responses to just about every supporter. And I've seen them. You know, there's slight variations, but pretty much they're copying and pasting and saying, we don't have to release the input data because this court ruling said so, and that's good enough. We don't have to even justify that, other than maybe terrorists, they have our input data available, they can use this information to bring down buildings, even though this building no longer exists. And if it really is just fires that brought it down, like Ness says, that's not really something that you need to look at input data to figure out. So Richard talked about our vision and why we are pursuing this project, Dylan. I know that you've done some other projects over the years focusing on other issues. What about this project attracted you to cover 9/11 again? And even though we don't have a final product yet to reflect on, being in the early creative stages now, can you talk about your vision of what this film is going to convey?
Yeah, I mean, we had four editions of Loose Change ultimately. We had the first and second, which I discussed. We had our third edition, which was originally supposed to be released in theaters by Magnolia Pictures. Charlie Sheen was going to narrate it. You know, Mark Cuban's producing group was behind it. And basically the project kind of fell apart at the 11th hour. And we had already done a bunch of work. We'd already promised people we were going to make a new edition. So we basically had to, I hate to say, cobble together a third edition. But I mean, the end result is not exactly what we envisioned. So, you know, with the third edition out, you know, I was more or less done with it. You know, I felt like I had said my piece and we didn't get to achieve what it was we wanted. But then I ran into Daniel Sunjata at the 9/11 2008 event in New York City, and he was like, hey man, if you ever decide to do another edition, or even if you want to get a new narrator for the third edition, like, let me know. And you know, due to all the baggage that existed with the third edition, I was like, well, you know, I don't want to just re-narrate that one. Like, let me try to come up with, you know, something else and something new. So through that process, 9/11 or Loose Change 9/11, An American Coup was born. That was distributed by Micro Cinema. It was on Netflix for a good couple years until Micro Cinema went bankrupt and a check bounced and Netflix canceled the contract. But I mean, we had a pretty good run on Netflix with that edition. You know, people were watching on there for years. And, you know, again, that was definitely the final Loose Change, you know. And since then, I've been attached to more 9/11 and, you know, quote unquote truth related projects than I can, you know, that I can even keep count of. You know, there was the one back in 2011 that was supposed to have Ed Asner and Martin Sheen and all these people attached, and it was basically going to be like a courtroom drama, recreating what was supposed to be a new investigation, but then the screenwriter basically turned out to be a fraud. So that project didn't get off the ground. I've had people approach me about doing this and doing that, and, you know, none of them have gotten off the ground, and I've told all of them, it's like, look, I mean, I don't necessarily want to dip my toes back into that pool, but, you know, if you come to me with something good and, you know, you have investors and you have a plan, I'll definitely consider it. And so obviously none of those ever came to fruition. But this is an interesting opportunity, and it's a very, first of all, it's not a full feature. Like, we're just doing a short documentary, so it's not like I basically have to reinvent the wheel and find a new way to approach the entirety of 9/11 all over again. And it has the scientific backing of the University of Fairbanks behind it. It's a four-year study. They did their own computer simulations. There's six figures of funding that went into it. So there's something to be said, and there's something new to be discussed, and we have a new angle. And we have a very specific angle that we haven't really been able to discuss before. And so, thankfully, due to the efforts of the supporters of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, we raised a budget. I'm able to hire an amazing director of photography and an amazing sound man that I've worked with before. You know, I feel, if nothing else, it will hopefully be the most professionally produced documentary, albeit a short, on the subject matter, even though, like I said, it's a very specific aspect of the subject matter. But I'm excited to just sit in the director's chair and ask interviews and help kind of guide this thing from start to finish. And, you know, I have a couple ideas on the vision and the approach. I don't know how much I should get into that on the show, but I you know, I am going for a very specific look, and I want people to watch this and say, I can't believe that this is a documentary about 9/11 and it's a documentary about Building 7. So, you know, there's a couple stylistic choices we're, you know, going after. There's a couple cinematic approaches I've talked to my DP about, you know, lenses we're going to use and angles and lighting and, you know, basically a lot of technical jargon. But it's great. You know, this gives me the opportunity to just direct, you know, all the editions of Loose Change. I've had to write a script. I've had to do the whole thing start to finish with basically no budget. I haven't had the ability to go and really do a lot of interviews. So this is a nice change of pace. I get to just direct it. And, you know, I'll be doing the editing as well. But, you know, it's a nice opportunity to just take a crew and shoot a bunch of interviews and cut them together and see what we come up with, which I guess makes it sound more haphazard than I plan on it being. So I assure people I'm going into this with a plan, but you don't really know until you have all your interviews and you have transcripts and you sit down to edit. But I'm very excited. You know, the plane tickets and lodging are booked. You know, we're wrapping up our equipment rentals and where we're going to get all our gear from. All our interviewees are booked. Schedules are cleared. Like, we're good to go. So we will be we'll be entering production on December 6th, and we will be wrapped on the 12th. We may or may not add a final shoot at the end, depending on A, how much budget we have left, and B, if we can get in touch with the people that we're specifically trying to get in touch with. It's unfortunate that, you know, the two key eyewitnesses that could be interviewed, theoretically, one is Michael Hess, who works for the city of New York, or at least did at the time, and we know we're not going to get an interview with him, and sadly, the other person is Barry Jennings, who, unfortunately, is no longer with us. So we're basically still trying to find a good key eyewitness that can shed some light onto what they saw that day. So I don't want to get into specifics, but as I said, there's two particular people that we're trying to track down. I don't know how successful we'll be with that, But one way or another, we hope to make the definitive piece on the collapse of Building 7.
Right, and I've heard some of the behind-the-scenes talk, and I'm not going to even pretend to understand everything involved, but I guess you have a very good camera. It's the same kind that's used to film a particular Netflix show and other equipment. And this isn't just creating something in your bedroom here. I mean, you guys got to travel to Alaska and California, other places where people that you're interviewing are located. It's no cheap thing to put something like what you're going to see in the final product. I'm talking to the audience now. What you're going to see in the final product is no cheap thing to put together. And I'm going to tell you, without our supporters, it would not be possible. The 9/11 Truth Movement comes through time and time and again because people know how important this is. I mean, we're almost 20 years. I'm going to round off to 20 here. We're almost 20 years after this event took place. And people know it still affects our daily lives here. It still affects the direction that our country is headed, and we can reverse it. I believe we can reverse it if we have an acknowledgement of what really happened that day. It's not too late. And I think it's that spirit and that knowledge that keeps people going and keeps them interested in projects like this and trying to help AE 9/11 Truth and its mission and other people as well. So the bulletin that we sent out to the supporters says that this documentary will be highlighting the extraordinary conclusions of the Building 7 study and the epic failure of our institutions to tell the truth about Building 7. And that last part of that line really caught my attention, something that I highlight a lot on this show. Obviously, the World Trade Center evidence, but also, why is it that we have to have a show that talks about this week after week in order to shed light on this important issue? Why is it that AE 9/11 Truth supporters have to get a film made with Dylan Avery to talk about something that we pay our taxes to NIST and all these other investigative agencies to look into and bring to light? I mean, we've had a lot of failure going on here in America around 9/11. And it's just fascinating. I think the sociology classes are going to be talking about this for years after this finally gets acknowledged. What happened in America to lead to this state of affairs where ordinary people have to do the government's job for it? Richard first and then Dylan, can you talk about the latter part of that statement, the failure of our institutions to tell the truth about Building 7, and lay out who, in your view, obviously, NIST, but who, in your view, these institutions are, and some specific examples that you've seen during your entire 9/11 Truth career pursuing this mission to really highlight that statement?
Yeah, this is pretty important, Andy. We have major agencies. NIST is the National Institute of Standards and Technology, who was tasked by Congress to explain these collapses to the American people. They took over an investigation from the American Society of Civil Engineers, who originally put forth volunteers to explain these collapses, but those volunteers then worked themselves through the FEMA report, which came out in May of 2002. Now, interestingly enough, the FEMA report did include a metallurgical examination of the steel in their Appendix C of that report, which finds that there's a hot temperature sulfur corrosion attack on the steel with liquid molten iron. Things, phenomena that doesn't happen in office fires or even with jet fuel. Of course, this building wasn't hit by a plane either. So where does all this molten metal seen by the first responders come from? I mean, why is this omitted from the key report? When NIST took it over, their final report includes none of that information about molten iron. In fact, John Gross of NIST, the co-project leader, actually denies this phenomena, even though he actually found the piece of steel that he gave to FEMA to document in their limited metallurgical examination, which includes hot sulfur corrosion attack. Well, how does steel get to the melted point? 2,800 degrees it takes to melt steel, Fahrenheit. Well, thermite is the answer, and there's evidence in all the World Trade Center dust samples of ignited and unignited thermite, which this report will touch on. this film that Dylan's creating. It'll also touch on the witnesses of explosives that NIST completely ignored after having denied that there's any that they found evidence for explosives. They actually acknowledged that they never looked for residue of explosives. And I mentioned they eliminated the entire Appendix C metallurgical examination, which proves that there's incendiaries here. There's no other possible explanation for this. They also denied the free fall of this building. They said early on, Shyam Sunder, the project leader, said, gosh, if there was free fall, that would mean there'd be no structure underneath it. Well, right. Yeah, he later acknowledges, after having been publicly embarrassed by members of AE 911 Truth in a press conference, that, gosh, maybe we should look into this. Well, they did then acknowledge that there's free fall acceleration in this building, meaning not one column gave any resistance to the collapse of this building. Well, what happened to those columns? Well, they had to have been removed. And that's what Professor Halsey proves. And that's what's so exciting about this film that Dylan's creating, because it's going to show this to the world in a media that cannot be denied. In fact, the mainstream media can't deny it either, because it'll be in their bailiwick now, a film that has to be acknowledged due to its incredible cinematic and directorial quality. So this is all really incredible evidence that our key federal agency put in charge by Congress to explain these collapses to the American people completely covered up. And the mainstream media, particularly with the censorship of this, and people ask me, gosh, well, why isn't this on CNN? This is the story of the century. The conspiracy, if you will, that had to go into effect and be organized so that Building 7, even Building 7 alone, had to have been set with explosive and incendiary shaped cutter charges. Well, this evidence has been ruthlessly censored in, you know, not one. Well, I've had a couple of local quasi-mainstream interviews, about six of them, Fox News, in different local interviews on TV, but they never get picked up nationally, except on C-SPAN, thanks to a brave supporter of ours who led a relentless call campaign. We got 45 minutes on C-SPAN, which then became the most watched video of their on their entire website. So persistence pays off, and that's what we're doing here by making yet another, and this time the best ever, film on Building 7. And it's going to take the 9/11 Truth Movement and beyond by storm.
Dylan, same question to you.
Well, I'm glad that Richard brought up the sulfidation of the steel inside Building 7, because that was going to be my go-to. I mean, I even remember reading about that back in 2002, 2003, because the complete 9/11 timeline that I mentioned earlier had eventually morphed into the site, which is basically 911archive.org, I believe. And it's basically a gigantic database of all things 9/11. It covers every aspect from the movements of the hijackers to events within the building, within the Twin Towers, and of course events pertaining to Building 7. And I remember even reading about that, the sulfidation of the steel and the extremely high temperatures that would have been required to achieve that. And I was like, well, I mean, that kind of seems like an open and shut case there. I mean, and then you couple that, you couple the evidence of the corrosiveness of the steel with NIST then later saying that they found no evidence of molten steel and there was no molten steel. They didn't test for explosives because they felt that there was no need to do so. That to me was kind of a big red flag. And I think, again, like it's the disingenuous nature of both NIST and the people working on the investigations that has really kind of cultivated this distrust that we see, because if they had been a little bit more forthcoming about things, if they had at least bothered to test for explosives, even if they didn't do it in earnest, even if they at least just, you know, said they did, like never actually did, like it's that arrogance, and it's that attitude where, well, we don't need to look into this because this isn't a concern of ours. Like, well, it may not be a concern of you guys, but it's a concern of many people. And for you to just sweep it under the rug and say that it doesn't exist or it doesn't matter, you know, I think that kind of set a lot of people off. It's the same thing with the 9/11 Commission establishing themselves and saying, we're not here to place blame. Like, okay, well, that's kind of your job to place blame. I mean, that's why you guys are here, you know? So I think across the board, every official investigative body that was tasked to look into 9/11, whether it be the 9/11 Commission, NIST, I don't want to include FEMA in that list because they at least mentioned the sulfidation of the steel, and they are the ones that made it possible for us to even know that happened in the first place. But any full-fledged official investigation into an aspect of 9/11 has been shown, at least in my opinion, to be severely flawed. And, you know, unfortunately, it is up to supporters of AE 9/11 Truth, and it's up to, you know, people like me, I guess, to really find out what happened that day. And so I'm, you know, again, not to be redundant, but, you know, and even just listening to Richard describe it, it's like, man, I'm kind of excited to see this thing now. So it's going to be interesting, without a doubt.
Yeah, and of course the media, which is the unofficial body that we count on to report real news, and they have failed epically. I don't even have time to get into all of this today, but I remember you guys, Dylan and Corey, and I think Jason Burmis was there, being interviewed by Nightline at a conference. And I don't know, you guys probably talked for like 20 minutes, and they shaved it down to like a few minutes or only used a few clips, and I believe it was completely misrepresented or just was re-edited to portray you guys in a negative light. Luckily, there was enough videos out there of what was really said at the conference during that interview for people to get the real deal.
Andy, I hate to cut you off, but the interesting thing about that is that we knew basically as soon as they showed up what their angle was and what agenda was going to be in play, and so that was part of their like initial thing is like, well, you know, there's a lot of 9/11 family members that feel insulted by the things you guys say. And we pointed over to Bob McElvain, who was about to give the speech, and we were like, there is a 9/11 family member right over there. Like, you should go talk to him. And the guy's like, no, we're not going to do that. It's like, okay, well then you guys are full of it then, because you're saying that this entire conference is an insult to 9/11 family members, and there is a 9/11 family member that is about to go up on the stage, and you won't even just placate us and go interview him. Like, you're not even going to do that. So yeah, that again, like, if you're gonna play that card, you know, if you're gonna play the 9/11 family member card, you should at least, you know, put in the effort to go over and speak to a 9/11 family member who is present at that conference.
Well, that's what gets me about it, is if they really didn't believe that Richard Gage and Dylan Avery and all the other great voices out there for 9/11 Truth didn't have a case, they would simply not cover it. And certainly we see a lot of it not being covered out there in the media, but right from the very beginning, and this is part of what got me awoken to the validity of the message and the big problem that we're in here in the Western world, is that they weren't just ignoring it, they were downright hostile. They weren't just refusing to cover it, they would cover it and then attack the people that were raising what I consider to be very legitimate questions. And it was just an antagonistic relationship between an entity that's claiming to be serving the people, but it's obviously not. It's just propagandizing them. So that's why 8911 Truth needs to exist. That's why Loose Change had to be created. And that's why this next film is going to be created too. And Richard, what's your hope after this film comes out? Where do you want to see it go? What do you want to see our supporters do with it when it's released?
Well, it has to go everywhere. It has to be seen by, for instance, the American Society of Civil Engineers. Every one of the engineers of this organization who have denied the publication in their peer-reviewed literature of challenges to the official story, basically put out by Zdeněk Bezant, for instance, and their reasoning, well, this paper's out of scope. Well, wait a minute. How can it be out of scope? It challenges the very theory that NIST continues to use to justify their theory of the Twin Towers collapse in this case. Also, it has to go to them, the American Society of Civil Engineers, because they have refused to have presentations in their conferences of this paper, which is produced by a major university, and it's a study that challenges the official cause of this building's collapse, which is fire. And many engineers have already come forth saying, man, this thing's solid. It's bulletproof. This completely destroys the NIST report, which not only the American Society of Civil Engineers has relied upon, but the American Institute of Architects, citing that this study has already been done. But guess what? The American Institute of Architects, of which I'm one of 80,000 members, has not issued one bulletin on this collapse, the third worst structural failure in modern history. It's absolutely extraordinary. They will not let us anymore, as of 2 years ago, show up at their conferences and show the architects that this building collapsed. We show the video. We say, do you know what this is? They say, oh, yeah, that's a controlled demolition. We say, do you know when this happened? We say that happened on 9/11. And they're going, what? That doesn't look like a twin tower to me. No, that's the third tower that collapsed. You didn't know about it? They are hardly any of them know about it. When the world sees this film, they're going to have eyes open and jaws dropped, and they're going to wonder how the media failed them, how their legislators failed them, how the executive branches since Bush has failed them. So it's got to go everywhere. It's got to go viral, and it's got to wake the world up about 9/11 truth, because, you know, this is just isn't about a building. Let's face it. Building 7 is a domino that's going to set all these dominoes about faith in these major institutions falling. It's going to set other dominoes falling, other problems that our government has created, other conspiracies, if you will, that have happened before and after 9/11. Once they realize, like I did 13 years ago now, that we were lied to about 9/11, we were sent into major wars. We killed a couple of million Muslims. Our own constitutional civil liberties had been demolished by the Patriot Act, the Military Commissions Act, the National Defense Authorization Act of 2012. This changed fundamentally our society. This is not about a building. It's about having been lied to fundamentally about the largest attack on American soil ever and the crime of the century. It's got to be solved. People's eyes have to be opened.
Absolutely, and their eyes will be opened. And I want to thank the supporters for all your efforts and raising the money for this film. We're going to have a great product when it comes out. And I know I'm going to have, Dylan, I'm going to have you back on the show once it comes out. We'll talk about the finished product there. And unfortunately, they only give me an hour of time on the network, so we are out of time. I want to wish you guys good luck. I wish you a good holiday coming up. And thank you so much for coming on 9/11 Freefall today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, man. Yeah, I'm excited. I'm excited to report back with how production went.
This program is on every Thursday night on No Lies Radio and every other Thursday night on BBS Radio at 10 o'clock Eastern, 7 o'clock Pacific. You can also keep track of the archives by going to 911freefall.com. This is Andy Steele saying have a great week and good luck.